Day 88 of the U.S.-Israeli genocidal war against the Gaza Strip. Death toll is nearing 22,200, mainly women and children. Islamic resistance groups in Iraq and Lebanon scale up operations against U.S. and Israeli bases, the retaliation for the ongoing war crimes against Palestinians. People in Iran and elsewhere commemorate the fourth assassination anniversary of the anti-terror commander, General Soleimani. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Now, almost 3 months into Israel's genocidal war in Gaza, the regime's warplanes and artillery keep pounding the blockaded territory. Gaza health officials say that Israeli forces have dropped more than a dozen bombs across Gaza in the past day, killing more than 150 people. That includes 15 people who were killed in a bombardment of a residential building in the city of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. 9 Palestinians, mostly children, were killed in artillery shelling, targeting a house and the Nusayrat refugee camp. The Israeli military also performed a missile strike on Rafah in the south and shelled the Jabalia refugee camp in the north. The regime's intensified its attacks in and around refugee camps, including Nusayrat, Al-Maghazi, and Al-Baraj. 22,185 Palestinians have been killed since the U.S.-Israeli genocide began in early October. Despite global demands for ceasefire, the Israeli military is saying that the onslaught is expected to continue throughout the year. Meantime, Tel Aviv is facing a scathing criticism for its calls to forcefully displace Palestinians from Gaza. Resistance movements denounce that plan as yet another instance of the regime's war crimes in the besieged territory. The Islamic Jihad movement says that such calls confirm the Israeli onslaught in Gaza as a war of genocide against the existence of Palestinians in their homeland. It says the silence in the face of such violations encourages the regime to continue its criminal agenda. The Islamic Jihad also warned that such crimes won't be limited to Gaza. They will also threaten all countries in the region. Now, after Smotrich, Ben-Gvir has become the second Israeli minister to call for the departure of Gaza's residents and the return of settlers to the territory. Resistance movement Hamas has vowed that Gazans would stand firm against such plots. Now, thousands of Palestinian people in Al-Baraj and Al-Nusayrat refugee camps in central Gaza Strip have been forced to leave their homes as the Israeli regime intensifies deadly bombardment of the Gaza Strip.
As a result of the threats by the Israeli occupation forces, thousands of the Palestinian families have collected only the most necessary of their belongings before leaving their houses in Al-Baraj, Al-Nusayrat, and Al-Maghazi refugee camps. Similar to the other families who were previously displaced from Gaza City and the northern parts of the blockaded strip, these families have no place to go but the schools, the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, and the surrounding vacant areas in Deir al-Balah City. The neighborhood has now turned into an overcrowded city of tents.
We were living in our house before we were forcibly expelled by Israeli threats. Now we are homeless, living in this shattered tent that has no roof, no floor, no walls, and no bathroom. Our life is miserable. We, mostly women, girls, and children, are cramped in this small tent with no access to the basic humanitarian needs. We are suffering from unbearable conditions and the Israeli strikes.
The family of Dima Maslih was among those lucky families who could find a place in the surrounding areas of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital. 10 members, including the parents, their children, and a paralyzed aunt, are crammed in a small tent that provides no cover or protection from rain or the freezing cold weather. It's needless to mention their daily struggle to find food to eat or water to drink.
Actually, I'm a refugee here in Al-Dir camp. Now As you see, I'm in a tent with 9 families. You know how much in 9 families there's like more than 10 people in every family. And we live like literally with simple materials to live. Like there is no covers, there is no supplies like water, like anything like food or covers. Actually, no one do anything here. They just stare about us and they don't do anything.
Dima is a 21-year-old Palestinian girl. She studies translation in the Al-Azhar University in Gaza, which is now reduced to rubble over the relentless Israeli airstrikes. Like all Gaza students, Dima has her own dreams of completing her college, having a good job, and live a peaceful life in her house. However, the Israeli occupation forces ruined all her dreams, as the vast part of Gaza Strip is transformed into a livable place.
Dima is another example of the Palestinian student whose life, future, and dreams were ruined by the Israeli regime that has been bombarding the besieged strip for roughly 3 months in a row. This sort of the barbaric bombardment against the besieged strip goes beyond any description in terms of a brutality against civilians. Mota Abu Msabih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
The military wing of the Islamic Jihad resistance movement has performed fresh attacks against Israel in response to its onslaught on Gaza. Hasaraya al-Quds says it's targeted several command centers of the Israeli military with rockets and missiles, causing damage. Now, footage released also shows a number of Israeli military vehicles fleeing after resistance fighters targeted a gathering of the regime's forces. Meanwhile, the military wing of the Hamas movement has issued a statement detailing the latest losses inflicted by its fighters on the Israeli military. The Al-Qassam Brigade says 71 Israeli armored vehicles have been fully or partially destroyed in Gaza in the past 4 days. Its fighters also killed 16 Israeli soldiers and wounding tens more in the same period. Al-Qassam says that more than 30 IDF soldiers have been injured in the past day alone. Now, at the same time, Israel is pressing ahead with its violent raids across the West Bank, killing more Palestinians there. 5 young people lost their lives during an Israeli raid on the village of Azzoun, east of the city of Qalqilia. A public mourning has been announced in that village. The Israeli military says that one of its soldiers was also injured in the raid. That's the latest in a series of attacks on the West Bank. The regime has stepped up deadly crackdown on Palestinians in the occupied territory since October 7th. In the last 3 months, hundreds of Palestinians have been killed. More than 4,000 others have been abducted in the West Bank. The Islamic resistance in Iraq has launched fresh attacks on American bases in Syria and Iraq in response to the U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza. Resistance groups said it targeted the al-Shaddadi military base in Syria's eastern Hasaka province with rockets. U.S. bases in the Kanako oil fields and al-Qadra village were also hit by drones. The group also confirmed an attack on a U.S. base near the Erbil International Airport in northern Iraq. No details about possible casualties or damage. Resistance groups have intensified strikes on U.S. bases and facilities in Iraq and Syria in retaliation for Washington's supports for Israeli bloodshed in Gaza. Since the beginning of the onslaught in October, Washington has provided Tel Aviv with more weapons and backed the Israeli war crimes of the United Nations. Now, Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says that 4 of its fighters have been killed in the latest Israeli attack in southern Lebanon. Regime's warplanes hit the southern towns of Kfar Kila and Al-Qudr. The attacks came hours after a resistance group targeted several Israeli military bases in the occupied territories. Hezbollah has been exchanging fire with Israel since the beginning of the onslaught on the Gaza Strip. The resistance movement says it attacks on retaliation for the U.S.-Israeli genocide in the Palestinian land. The movement's Deputy Secretary General, Sheikh Naim Qassem, recently stressed that attacks on Israel will end only if the regime stops its onslaught against Palestinians. Now, for an update on the exchange of fire between Israeli occupation forces and Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement, let's go to Beirut and bring in Mariam Saleh, our correspondent there. Mariam, good to have you with us. So walk us through the latest developments.
Well, the Israeli shelling has not stopped, as you very well know. We know that they are using also more airstrikes than they did previously. There were several also drone attacks against the towns of Tayr Harfa and also another town of Kunin, basically on the outskirts of those villages, since they are not in the border villages. But the border villages have been hit hard by Israeli airstrikes, basically even in the heart of the towns, destroying residential houses. We've seen that in Bint Jbeil, Ait Harun, in Marun Ras, as well as in Kfar Kila. We also had in Kfar Kila an incident where there were several paramedics that were also killed as a result of the airstrikes. And, of course, the shelling continues as we speak on an hourly basis. Of course, Hezbollah today had also operations, since the operations have not stopped since the Al-Aqsa flood operation began, except during the truce. But today we had some significant operations. There was a drone attack, an airstrike, basically, by Hezbollah using a kamikaze drone against the 91st Division. And that was done with, we can see that they have actually moved that division. They continue to move its headquarters. Now it was in northeastern, the occupied town of Zar'it, and that is, the town of Safad, the occupied town of Safad, which is for the Israelis, it's called Elite, and that was where Hezbollah used a drone in order to attack that headquarters specifically. We can notice how Hezbollah usually uses drones in order to launch their airstrikes when they are launching an attack, which is a bit further off from the border, except when they're retaliating for civilians. That is when they actually launch a savoy of Katyusha rockets, but this time they used drones in order to attack the 91st Division, like we said, in the Israeli settlement of Elite, which is the occupied Palestinian town of Safad on the northeastern part of that town specifically. But we had four other operations. We had a rocket attack against the Sumaqa base in the occupied Lebanese Kfar Shaba Farms. We also had another operation in Birkat Risha as well as in Al Marj. Those were done using precise rockets, as we know, they were done using specific targeting of anti-tank or drones, or even not drones, the other one was the drones was done in Safad. Those we had, they said, suitable or different missiles that are used maybe in specific targets against those bases. And so it is basically the same when it comes to those resistance operations, except for the drone attack, which is, of course, it was different today. We had a new area that was targeted. The operations, of course, have continued for a very long time. Throughout this confrontation, we heard, as you said, from the officials like Sheikh Naim Qasim, who stressed that the operations will continue as long as the aggression against Gaza has also continued.
All right. Thanks for that, Mariam Saleh, our correspondent in Beirut. Now, January the 3rd marks the anniversary of the U.S. assassination of Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani. On the eve of the fourth anniversary, people are holding ceremonies to pay respect and remember the late commander of Iran's IRGC. Events are being held in different Iranian cities, including in Kerman, the hometown of General Soleimani. He was assassinated together with his Iraqi companion, al-Muhandis, in a U.S. drone attack in Baghdad in 2020. General Soleimani is revered both at home and in the region as an anti-terrorist icon due to his pivotal role in fighting terrorist groups like Daesh. Iran has vowed to bring to justice the perpetrators of the general's assassination. The Iranian foreign minister has described Israel's genocidal onslaught against Gaza as a total failure. He says that a regime has been forced to contact Hamas on the future of the Gaza Strip.
The Zionist regime pursued its dreams. They announced that they want to eliminate Hamas, but it didn't happen. Today, the same leaders of the occupying regime of Israel and U.S. officials who talked about eliminating Hamas are sending messages to Hamas and holding indirect talks in third countries on the governance of post-war Gaza and an exchange of Palestinian captives with Israeli occupation captives.
Well, CNN Abdullah Hyan says that Tel Aviv could not free its captives held in Gaza through military means. It's now resorted to political approaches. He said that Israel and its allies have two options now: to continue the futile and costly onslaught or to go for political talks in which Hamas has the upper hand. The Iranian minister said that some American officials believe that the U.S. should not have thrown its full weight behind Israel. Amir Abdullahian says that Washington is now looking for a face-saving solution to get itself out of the quagmire it finds itself in Gaza.
Today, the challenge at the White House is that U.S. politicians have made a mistake and stepped into a fight and quagmire in Gaza, and now it's costly for them to get out of it. The U.S. now seeks a face-saving way out of the Gaza fray.
Now, the Iranian top diplomat said that the course of the Israeli onslaught shows the resistance in Gaza is on the right path and has managed to achieve a second victory after Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. He also held Hamas' October 7th operation against Israel that dealt a very serious political, security, and psychological blow to the regime. And that's a wrap for this newscast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at the recent legacy bill that was passed at Westminster. How does this now affect victims, and what can be done to repeal it? My next guest is a columnist and regular political commentator on broadcast television. She is also Deputy Director of Relatives for Justice, a national victim support NGO which provides advocacy and therapeutic support for the bereaved and injured of the conflict. As always, we are joined by our resident co-presenter, Michelle Gildernew. Michelle is the current MP for Fermanagh South Tyrone. She has served in the Northern Ireland Assembly as a former Minister for Agriculture and Rural Development and chairperson of the Health Committee, amongst other things. Michelle has been a Sinn Féin activist since her teens and has been elected almost continuously since 1998. And today's guest is Andre Murphy. Andre is a human rights advocate working on behalf of victims affected by political violence during the recent conflict. Andre Murphy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Sean. Lovely to be here.
Great to see you.
So, Andre, tell me a bit about your childhood growing up.
Well, I was born in Dublin in the 1970s, grew up in what was, I suppose, a really emerging Ireland at that stage. You know, it was very poor. There was a massive recession, especially during the 1980s. And we were just, you know, a family affected by all of that economic environment. When I was 15, we moved to Talla, which was at that stage a big sprawling housing estate where there was no footpaths. You had to go across fields to be able to get to a bus. maybe every hour that ran. And I can remember it just being a little bit grinding, you know, that everything seemed in black and white in Dublin, where everywhere else looked like it was in colour. But I loved it.
And were you always interested in human rights? So where did that come from?
I think growing up in Dublin and what I've just described, where you'd be in a place where nobody had any money, and particularly women. And women at that stage had no effective rights. And, you know, I can remember when the marriage bar went in the civil service. Mm-hmm. You know, my mother, because my parents split up, received a benefit called the Deserted Wives Allowance. If you were a child, if you were unmarried at that stage, you got and you had children, you had a unmarried mother's allowance and whatever. That was the type of society we lived in. Yet women ran everything while men were unemployed or maybe had to go away. Women kept Dublin running and the communities that we were in. And I can remember then that sense of, you know, we here have no money. We've no access to effective education. We've got women who are going through all of this. And, you know, where's the rights? Where are we as equal citizens? There is no sense of equal citizenship.
And you became Deputy Director of Relics for Justice. What kind of, can you just, for the audience's sake, tell us what kind of services that victims can avail of?
Yeah, so Relatives for Justice comes from families coming together to say us too. So people who were affected by state violence in particular, their experience of violence and of violent bereavement was completely dismissed, where they weren't seen as equal victims. And so all of our services, whether it's advocacy where they're pursuing legal justice through different avenues, whether it's recording their own story, trying to break imposed state narratives or censored narratives, or whether it's even seeking support with the traumatic effects of that experience, was very, very difficult for many families. How do you go, if you've been affected by a state violation, to an arm of the state and talk about your life falling apart? You're afraid that the state is also going to perhaps take your children. You're afraid that you're going to be sectioned and taken away from your family. So for us, our support came very, very organically, where we were stepping into the places where the state had failed families. How can you support someone going to an inquest, for example, if they don't have money to be able to pay the rent or to buy food? How can you engage in any sort of education if you can't even walk through the door at night because you're so afraid, because your father was killed at night and you've never been able to cross the door since? Those are the type of organic, connected support services we're able to provide now.
So, Andre, you've been nurturing victims for decades now. How do the people that you work with feel about the latest proposals that have been forced through the British government around legacy?
Michelle, I've been doing this for over 20 years with families who have seen the very worst of days. And the Legacy Bill is having an impact that I have never seen before. So for them, it is the British government saying their loved ones didn't matter. It's saying that what they did is completely okay. And it's saying they, as living relatives, and their experiences don't matter. It's saying that they are second-class citizens, that they are not beneficiaries of our peace process in any way, shape or form, that they are inconvenient, that they are to be dismissed. So for this is intergenerational. So we can think of people who, when their brother or sister were killed when they were children, they will talk about, on that day we lost our parents as well, because the trauma was so horrendous and the silence descended on their families. So for them to be able to then 10, 20 years later, in the context of a peace process, pursue justice, record narratives, say, let's have due process for my brother or my sister, and their parents pass away and pass on a mantle to them. For this to happen now with this legacy legislation is telling that family that they are not only letting down their brother and sister, they're also letting down their parents. And the devastation... I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. That came out of nowhere. I I'm really sorry. The devastation for that family is not about a piece of law. It's not about whether they can get into a court. It is about the erasing of the memory of their child, of their brother, sister, their spouse, their parents. That's what this is doing. And what that does to a family and its impact can only be seen through our phones the day after, where people are expressing suicidal thoughts. They're not just saying, I am traumatised, I'm not coping. They're saying, I want to take my own life because the life, my life is no longer worth living. Not only was the life of my loved one taken away, but my life is no longer worth living. Chris Heaton Harris was quaffing champagne the night this was passed because they think they've done a good thing, because they don't have to look in the eyes of these mothers who know they are going to die, who are going to die before their children's justice is delivered, the truth about their child, who was not a gunman or a gunwoman, who was not someone that the British Army could just take away and snuff out their life and then cover up the files and hide them away for until 2064 or 2070. Those women know they're going to die without having any of truth and without any justice. Chris Heaton Harris doesn't have to look in any of their eyes. And it doesn't matter if it was the British Army or the RUC or the IRA or loyalists that took those lives. Those loved ones mattered. Mm-hmm. And those families matter. And what this is doing is inhumane in an extraordinary way that no one in a developed country in 2023 should even be cognizant of.
And Andre, so what can we do? I mean, what can the general public do, or what can we do to repeal this or to have this reversed?
It occurs to me that there are many people who don't even know what's happened. I think maybe people in the north in these six counties know. People in the south don't know. People in mainland Britain certainly don't know, unless their loved one happened to be in some way caught up in the conflict, maybe as a British soldier who died here, or if they were caught in a bombing committed by the IRA in Britain. That's the only way that they would know, because there has been no conversation about this. It hasn't impacted. You can tell even that the politicians who passed this haven't thought twice about it, because they don't matter. Irish lives haven't mattered. For people to get involved, they need to start saying these people matter. They need to find out the names of those who've killed. So the Julie Livingstons, the Carol Ann Kellys. They need to find out those names. And then they need to go to the MPs and they need to sit in front of them and say this is wrong. They need to say to the Irish government, who are currently, in fairness, saying this was a unilateral action outside the terms of the Good Friday Agreement in a breach of the peace process. The Irish government needs to know that they have the back of people, that people have their backs when they say we could take this to the European Court of Human Rights as an interstate case. They need to go and do that. And they know they need to go and do it, but they need to know that they have the support of people when they go and do it, because it's a very, very significant step to take. People in America need to really tell the British government this is going to have implications. We said during Brexit that would have financial implications when the British government acted unilaterally because it threatened the Good Friday Agreement. Why isn't that same pressure coming on the British government now from America? Why isn't the same pressure coming on from citizens here? We need to stand up for not only the dead, but also for the families who are living, so that they don't feel that they need to, that their lives are not worth living.
We facilitated meetings in Westminster with some of the victims' families, mm-hmm. and to be honest, there wasn't a lot of interest from MPs in no. Britain. What do you think is next for the victims in terms of the next practical steps?
Practically, we need to put the pressure on the Irish government. We need to say to them about an interstate case that goes to the European Court. There are some families who are working with their lawyers and collectively with law firms where there are going to be challenges that go through the domestic courts. Mm. This won't go away. You know, it will just mean that the parents will all be dead. Most of the spouses will be dead. It will be the children and grandchildren of those killed. We are sentencing our two countries to perpetual trauma if we don't resolve this.
Just moving on slightly, Andre, you spoke recently about censorship in the media. Now, we're seeing a change in landscape, obviously, with the proliferation of digital and social media. But just for the audience's sake, just to give them an awareness of how draconian legislation was here for marginalised voices, and I'm thinking Section 31 in particular. Can you give the audience a sense of what that was like?
It was so much more than just a piece of legislation. It was a way of thinking. Section 31 had always been part of the Broadcasting Act in the South. But in the early 1970s, there was a decision by the government, along with a new RTE, to decide how they would report the North, whose voices they would exclude. We only ever talked about Ireland as the 26 counties, so the North was excluded. The conflict that was raging, the human rights violations that were happening, were completely underreported, to the point that, you know, the Dublin and Monaghan bombings went off when I was a baby, right? I grew up not knowing that the bombs happened, let alone many people blaming the IRA for those bombs having gone off, even though it was the largest single atrocity in the entire of our conflict. And that was the impact of Section 31. It said that the North was other, the voices of those being harmed were other, dangerous, something you didn't want to be engaged in. And it meant then that peace was much harder to achieve. It meant that I think we're still recovering from the imposition of a form of partition where people are, you know, the same citizens, same background, same history. An example might be something like the RTE programme, The Late Late Show, seen on the entirety of this island on a Friday night, the biggest show on the island, on both sides of the border, has a competition and it excludes the six counties, puts a map up, a physical map, where it's like the sea is there instead of the northern six counties. What does that say to all of the citizens who are here? It's saying they're other. But it also says to the citizens in the 26 counties, they are other. It was so effective in doing that. But I think most egregiously what it did was it said to a people who were under militarisation, who were experiencing daily violations, that their voices could be silenced. It wasn't just members of the IRA. It wasn't just members of Sinn Féin who were censored. It was also the entire community from which they came. And that was totally deliberate. It was a total political onslaught against a community who were engaged in resisting military occupation, resisting the Orange State, resisting discrimination and basic human rights abuses. And you know, it went way beyond law. It was much more of a mindset. When it was introduced in the British Broadcasting Act too, it compounded the idea that people who were representative of and representing those who had been marginalised and discriminated against could be silenced. So that meant that those violations were silenced too, that they were considered dangerous and somehow illegitimate. It illegitimised an entire community. And then when that community kept on saying, but we want the conditions for peace, we want to build the conditions where there are universal human rights, not partial, not something that was something for one community and not another, then that in some way could be silenced as well. And I think it made the peace process far harder to achieve, sustain and flourish.
And then, so there's a very real and lasting legacy of the legislation. Do you think, is it still difficult? Is the landscape still difficult for those marginalised to voice their opinions? Do you think that, even though the Act itself is gone, the impact is still felt?
I think you absolutely see it. You know, I think that during the conflict there was an idea that state collusion with loyalist paramilitaries, for instance, was Republican propaganda. Since those days, we've had repeated state reports evidencing that collusion. But even still today, you will have people who can say that there doesn't need to be accountability for those crimes. There doesn't need to be any sense of the British government doing anything more than saying, we apologise, and then moving on. And so they can still form the narrative that this was two communities in fighting with each other. The British government was in some way some neutral agent. You know, this legislation is a really good example of that, where they pretend they are neutral and they are only trying to bring reconciliation between these warring communities, when in fact there's something very, very different at work. There's vested interests in saying what this conflict looked like and what their involvement in this conflict looked like. Perpetuate those myths all the time. So it is twice as hard, if not 10 times as hard, for a victim of state violence or of collusion to be heard as a legitimate voice compared to someone who's perhaps affected by Republican actions. And that is really regrettable, because of course we don't want to create a disparity between victims in any way, shape or form. But my goodness, we see words like innocent coming in, or we see all kinds of different variations of how we will treat victims and survivors, or how we will treat narratives of the conflict in any way, shape or form. And that hampers our recovery.
So Andre... We all know what the British have been trying to do with this legacy bill. We've suffered it within our own communities, British state oppression, for many, many years. We've understood the obfuscation. We've understood them hiding truth for victims for many, many years. This legacy bill only copper fastens what we already know. But thinking from a more international sense of things, and this could be another view, how do you see that this current legacy bill in an international dynamic, for example, the British abroad, and how that affects maybe atrocities being committed in the future abroad?
Absolutely. So I think a big turning point for the debate was when Article 2 was applied to Iraq, where there were victims of British state violence in Iraq in holding centres, essentially. And so the Article 3 and Article 2 of the ECHR was applied. And so all of a sudden you had vested interests in Britain then saying, oh, we thought that we could just go to all of these foreign places and we thought that we could do whatever we wanted and never be held accountable. And then the accountability thing starts to happen, where it isn't just that people release reports or concerns, they actually start to be held to account for their actions, quite like here. And so then they change what they can do. So first of all, they thought they could get away with foreign theatres. They thought that if they committed the violations in Afghanistan or Iraq, they would just create an environment of amnesty for those actions. But then they realised that they would have to do it here as well, because families were securing tiny, tiny measures of accountability for British state actions on this island. So they've created amnesty for all of it. And that has got to be of concern to the international community. The idea that a sovereign nation, who is a founding signatory to the European Convention, to the International Conventions on Human Rights, that they would be able to circumvent all of their human rights obligations, go to any country, carry out the most egregious of violations, and then count themselves completely unaccountable. Surely that has to worry the entire international community.
But unfortunately, we haven't heard enough condemnation either. And I think that's where we need to. That's the next step.
I think you're right. I think that you can see the human rights community. So the United Nations have said this is terrible. The European Commissioner for Human Rights has voiced concerns. But the nation states haven't. Mm. We haven't seen that engagement from the states. And that's the difference to Brexit, where there was a rogue state attitude around leaving the EU and their way of leaving the EU. The states got involved because they could see that it was in their interest to do it. On this, families have been completely abandoned and human rights have been completely abandoned by the nation states. And that's who we need to, you know, it would make a quantifiable difference if we saw the kinds of commentary that we had seen from the likes of Luxembourg or from the Swedish nation or whatever around Brexit. If we started seeing that around legacy, I think it could make a big difference.
Well, Andre, we're all very proud of your work, the work that you and Mark do at Relics for Justice. And want to thank you for coming in today. It's always good to see you.
Thanks so much for having me. Okay.
Thanks a million.
This week we take a look at the use of censorship during the recent conflict. Both Section 31, enacted in the Irish Republic, as well as the British broadcasting ban, were deployed to marginalise growing support for Sinn Féin. With the party as popular as ever with voters as they've ever been, was censorship a wise decision in hindsight?
Censorship has been widely deployed as a tool to silence radical or alternative voices during the recent conflict. In 1971, Fianna Fáil Minister for Justice Gerry Collins invoked Section 31 of the Republic of Ireland's Broadcasting Ban, forbidding broadcasters to interview or report statements by anyone speaking on behalf of a number of organisations, the most prominent of which was Sinn Féin. The Labour Party Minister, Conor Cruise O'Brien, further strengthened the ban in 1977 in an effort to halt the increasingly sophisticated media communication skills of the party. A similar ban was replicated by Britain in October 1988. The restrictions, announced by the Home Secretary, Douglas Hurd, covered 11 organisations based in the north of Ireland. Broadcasters quickly found ways around the ban, chiefly by using actors to dub the voices of banned speakers, with the renowned actor Stephen Ray becoming the voice of Gerry Adams. The restrictions caused difficulties for British and Irish journalists who spoke out against censorship imposed by various other countries, such as Iraq and India. After the legislation around Section 31 lapsed in January 1994 in the Republic of Ireland, the British Prime Minister, John Major, lifted the broadcast ban on the 16th of September 1994, a fortnight after the first Provisional Irish Republican Army ceasefire, declared on the 31st of August 1994. For the first time in many years, a level political playing field saw marginal and alternative voices emerge from the cold.
And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd like to thank our special guest, Andre Murphy, and our resident co-host, Michelle Gildernew. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Ocean of Dua.
In the name of Allah, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll adopt a thematic approach towards supplication, and we'll have a look at supplication from the point of view of different verses of the Holy Quran. And we'll also have a look at some parts of the transmitted supplications as well as the whispered prayers. So stay with us. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil Brothers and sisters, as you were previously with us, we were discussing the concept of supplication. We said that based on the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt, there are many conditions to be met if the supplication is to be responded to. Now, we mentioned a couple of conditions regarding the very first constituent. We said that this kind of spiritual attraction is one of the most significant assets God has bestowed upon us, the servants. We read in Imam Ali alayhi salam's will to Imam Hussein alayhi salam, mentioned in Nahjul Balagha, that Imam Ali alayhi salam says and actually introduces this kind of great asset to his son, Imam Hassan. ثُمَّ جَعَلَ فِي يَدِكَ مَفَاتِيحَ خَزَائِنِهِ بِمَا أَذِنَ لَكَ فِيهِ مِنْ مَسْأَلَتِهِ. Then, my son, Allah has put in your hands the keys of his treasures. When? When he allowed you to ask him for what you like. فَمَتَى شِئْتَ استفتحت بالدعاء أبواب نعمه. So whenever you like, you can open with supplication the doors of his blessings. واستمطرت شابيب رحمته. Whenever you want, you could open up from his mercy. Imam Sajjad alayhi salam has said, الحمد لله الذي أناديه كلما شئت لحاجتي. Praise be to Allah, whom I call whenever I like, and become alone with him without an intercessor, so that he achieves my needs. فَيَقْضِي لِي حَاجَتِي. So, supplication, as we can say, is a huge abundance and blessing which Allah the Beneficent has given to his servants. It is a treasure exposed to these servants. So, anyone who is lucky enough to gain it will have an immense asset. This is the very first constituent. This is the very point that we need to understand if we want to understand the entity, the spirit, the concept of supplication. Despite the fact that it may be answered or not, supplication is a great virtue by itself. In the morning supplication, we read, إِلَهِ إِن لَمْ تَبْتَدِئْنِ الرَّحْمَةَ مِنْكَ بِحُسْنِ التَّوْفِيقِ فَمَنِ السَّالِكُ بِي إِلَيْكَ فِي وَاذِحَ الطَّرِيقِ. Oh my God, if you do not bestow upon me your mercy by making me succeed in turning towards you, then who is going to guide me to you in the clear way?
Why do we make supplication? And why do we call out to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Is it because God is not aware of our needs? God is Al-Alim. He knows all of our needs. Is it because God needs convincing? God is known as Al-Jawad. He is the source of generosity. Then why am I making dua to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? The dua is a journey of realizations. When a person goes to the ocean and he takes with him a bucket that can carry 4 liters of water, the ocean is infinite. In as much as your vessel is large, that is the amount of water that the ocean will give you. And therefore, our goal is to expand our capacity. Rumi has a very beautiful poem. He says, Har khujo mushkil javab onjo ravad. Wherever there is a problem, that is where the answer will come. Wherever there is a vessel, that's where the water will come. Don't go seeking for water. Instead, create the thirst within you. So that the water may burst forth from above and from below you. Experience that realization that you need God, and the mercy of God will come towards you. Paradise, thank you Allah. Now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, and we know we'll be here forever. Feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
Brothers and sisters, Imam Hussein alayhi salam says in Arafa supplication, إلهي أطلبني برحمتك حتى أصل إليك واجذبني بمنك حتى أقبل عليك. Oh my God, invite me with your mercy to join you and attract me with your favor so that I approach to you. It sometimes happens that a man, in difficult times of depression, does everything and resorts to any kinds of means, but he forgets supplication. Despite the fact that the only way of salvage is supplication. Despite the fact that supplication is introduced as the key to open the doors of vast ocean of mercy of the Almighty Allah whenever the supplicant, whenever the servants want. So after suffering a lot of hardships, after realizing that nobody could help him, after realizing that the supplicant, the servant, has got no one to turn to, one resorts to supplication. Of course, this is reckoned as a success itself, but the real success is obtained when we resort to supplication at the initial stages of coming across with an impassable hurdle, so that God may open up His doors of blessings and abundance before we get into a state of despair. Shaykh Al-Kulayni, concerning this issue, reports from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam saying, هَلْ تَعْرِفُونَ طُولَ الْبَلَاءِ مِنْ قِصَرِهِ. Do you recognize a long or a short duration of calamity? And the people, the companions said no. And he said, if at the time of disaster, it is inspired to one of you to engage in supplication, إِذَا أُلْهِمَ أَحَدُكُمُ الدُّعَاءَ عِنْدَ الْبَلَاءِ, then he should realize that the disaster will last short. فَعْلَمُوا أَنَّ الْبَلَاءَ قَصِيرٌ. Concerning this, it is said and reported from Imam Kalim alayhi salam that says, مَا مِنْ بَلَاءٍ يَنْزِلُ عَلَىٰ عَبْدٍ مُؤْمِنٍ فَيُلْهِمُهُ اللَّهُ عَزَّ وَجَلَّ الدُّعَاءَ. When a calamity befalls a faithful servant, and Allah inspires him to engage in supplication, that calamity will soon disappear. إِلَّا كَانَ كَشْفُ ذَٰلِكَ الْبَلَاءِ وَشِيكَ. وَمَا مِنْ بَلَاءٍ يَنْزِلُ عَلَىٰ عَبْدٍ مُؤْمِنٍ فَيُمْسِكُ عَنِ الدُّعَاءِ إِلَّا كَانَ ذَٰلِكَ الْبَلَاءُ طَوِيلًا. But if one, when afflicted with a calamity, refrains from supplication, that calamity will last long. فَإِذَا نَزَلَ الْبَلَاءُ فَعَلَيْكُمْ بِالدُّعَاءِ. So, when there is a disaster, keep on invoking Allah. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,880 kHz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.